Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today our special guest to be interviewed is...
You!
Me! Why?
Today is all dedicated to the Philip Coppins enigma. Philip has a new book that just came out last Tuesday, The Lost Civilization Enigma. The amazing, exciting, beautiful... follow-up to his best-selling book, The Ancient Alien Question. So we decided, who better to interview Philip Coppins about this amazing book than me? Because I've been here through a lot of this research for the last few years, and Philip does an enormous amount of radio, and I mean an enormous amount of radio. A lot of our lives are dictated by Philip's radio schedule. And I listen to him answer the same questions over and over and over again and give the same explanations. So this is a challenge for me to try to come up with some new questions that he has not answered yet and to look at things a little bit differently. But this is a really, this book is very, very special to me because this whole concept of lost civilizations is one of my grand passions. And, you know, one of the things certainly that brought us together is that we have these shared mutual passions, and it's what caused our paths to cross. And one of the magical things about our relationship is that when Philip and I met, we realized we'd been walking the same trail, sort of parallel beside each other for about 15 years. In fact, when we look at our lives, the years before we met, there were so many occasions where we were in the same town or the same place, investigating the same enigma or the same story, and our paths just hadn't crossed until ultimately it was time for that to happen. So there are a lot of places where our research has intersected, a lot of places that we have worked on together over the last couple of years. But this has been Philip's grand passion for most of his adult life, and it has created an absolutely beautiful book, The Lost Civilization Enigma.
That is true. It's one of my books, which I'm very proud to have written. It's, as you say, sort of like the national successor to The Ancient Alien Question.
Okay, so first of all, let's talk about the success of The Ancient Alien Question. The book was huge and did very well and will continue to do well for a long time. Of course, spurred along by the show Ancient Aliens, which is going into season 5. Very exciting. Why was the lost civilization enigma? Why was this idea of lost civilizations the natural progression for you in terms of the next book?
Well, not everything to do with our ancestors involves ancient aliens. Some lost civilizations have become also debatable from an ancient alien perspective. For example, in what I would say New Age culture, the topic of Atlantis has been made into something which I think it never was. This kind of crystal-like high-tech society with flying spaceships from the Pleiades or whatever, that is far beyond what our ancestors were saying. And to a large extent, this is a great disservice to our ancestors, to Atlantis, and also to getting Atlantis back on the map. The question which I pose in The Ancient Alien Question is obviously, were we alone? And the answer is no, we weren't. And the question, of course, is for the lost civilization enigma, were we the first? And the answer there is no either. Science is the common problem here. And it's science with a big S. Because in The Ancient Alien Question, what you have is basically the raising of the bar. Constantly, you know, scientists want us to jump higher. It's like going to the Olympics in the high jump and you have to jump 2.25 meters to qualify for the finals. And when you jump, all of a sudden there's an official there and says like, oops, sorry, you know, you now need to jump 2.30. Oh, you jumped 2.30? 2.35. Oops, you jumped 2.35. 2.40. Oh, 2.40, damn it, 2.45. At which point in time you kind of go, excuse me, this is like world record place now. Why do I need to jump 2.45? And basically science will tell you it's simply because we ask you to. So that is kind of like the raising of the bar and the reluctance of science to look into the ancient alien question. And when it comes to the lost civilization enigma, it has to do with the fact that I think science is actually partly responsible for this idea of creationism, this notion that somehow the earth was made 6,000 years ago, because science refuses to look at things beyond that. Specifically, textbook science is still stuck in this, nothing is older than 4,000 BC. Göbekli Tepe, you know, as much emphasis which it is getting from the alternative press, Katil Yuvik has been around for 20-30 years. This is a big city 8,000 years old, which sporadically gets mentioned, but is still not part of the ordinary curriculum of what children are told in school. We still kind of keep doing this 4,000 BC thing. And it's also because science and history has defined the game as such that history begins with writing. Now, that is very much an easy way out for them. Writing is not the summum of civilization. That is, we could redefine this and say, well, you know, we need to define the summum of civilization with television. Writing doesn't define civilization. It's easy for scientists because they kind of like and go like, oh, it's written so we can verify it, which is great, which is a scientific tool, all in favor of that. But somehow it has gone as defining history from prehistory. And that is simply such a bad situation to be in because, in my opinion, it doesn't define civilization. To me, civilization is about far more than that. And when you start looking at the aspects of civilization, what we find is that there is this commonality, which is that somehow in the past, and this is a distant past, you know, we have been around for about 30,000 years. And very early on in our existence, we figured out that we were more than just what we were able to see with our senses, that we were a spirit, that there was something behind life, that there was a larger reality. And we began to slowly figure out that we might have incarnated for a specific reason, that there might be such a thing as reincarnation. And then we began to build temples. We began to realize that we could communicate with our ancestors, with the gods, whatever you want to call them. And so to a large extent, the two books do go together in the sense that the first one says there are non-human intelligences out there. And the second one actually says, and we have been communicating with them for tens of thousands of years. And this is truly the sign of civilization. And we have, you know, lost contact with the beginning of civilization as such, and the fact that we're not alone.
Well, and I think that this book is the necessary follow-up to the Ancient Alien question, because in a lot of ways, it's the Ancient Alien answer. And by that, I don't mean it tells us were there ancient aliens and, you know, did aliens participate in the building of these civilizations. But it speaks to something that you and I talk about a lot. And even recently at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis, which was an excellent and amazing event, and you've probably heard us rave about this both on the air and on Facebook, this event in Minneapolis that was a full weekend event a couple of weeks ago in October. They're doing it again next year with really some of the most sort of progressive thinkers in this field. It was so much fun. And the sheer genius and brain power that was in the rooms during that weekend was extraordinary. And I'm including the audience in that because it was a very educated and informed audience. So it was really so much fun. But I do have an issue with a couple of the speakers who take this very strong position that everything was built by aliens. You know, raise your hand if you believe that these things could only have been built by aliens, was actually something that happened at the end of one of the speakers' presentations. And certainly I did not raise my hand, and neither did you, because one of the things that, you know, I know you care about, and certainly I do as well, is that people don't believe that just because you're on Ancient Aliens as a regular, or even that I'm on it periodically, that we believe all things were created by aliens all the time. And I think that it's easy to get tarred with that brush. And what I'm always concerned about is that we are not giving human intelligence and human accomplishment enough credit, that we're not saying, hey, humans built this. Humans created this because they had understandings that somewhere along the line we have lost. Now, did those understandings come from another place? That's an entirely different question. But the fact is, a lot of these extraordinary civilizations that which there is a lot of evidence for, were created by humans, with or without help. At this point, I don't think really matters. What I think that you're looking at with this book is, let's look at these lost civilizations, and let's look at all the dating and all the information that's come out about them, and let's ask the question, which is, why is science ignoring all of these things? You know, there's a couple of major chapters in this book that I truly love. I would like to start with Bosnia. Bosnia, having just come back from Bosnia and coming off of several weeks of being in the Bosnian pyramid complex, being there with Sam Osmanagic. You had Sam on the show a couple of weeks ago. You have been involved with the Bosnian pyramids pretty much since their discovery. And we see over and over again that scientists are absolutely terrified of the Bosnian pyramids and of the dating on them. And while we were there in September, a very extraordinary date came through on some of the organic material that coats the top of the pyramids at 24,000 years. 24,800, I believe, was the actual number of the first carbon date that came back. And we were all very excited about that. But also the way that that date, not just that it's a very old date, but where it feeds in, how it connects to the old Europe civilization, how it connects to the dates of the Lascaux Caves, how it connects even to what Manetho was saying in the King's List. Can you talk a little bit about this date of 24,000 years?
Yes, I mean, you know, when you're confronted with a date of let's say, 25,000 years, because it's 24,800, give or take 200 years. So 25,000 years ago might seem ridiculously far off, and it is because we are told that this is ridiculously far off. When it comes to things like Stonehenge, you know, you have Stonehenge, which traditionally is dated to roughly 3,000 BC, and then onwards to about 1,200 BC. Well, in Stonehenge, you have, specifically in the last few decades, discoveries which were being made there, and they gave dates to 8,000 BC. On all occasions, i.e. three, the evidence was pushed aside. It's like, oh, well, yes, there was something in 8,000 BC, but what was there in 8,000 BC has nothing to do with Stonehenge. It just so happens that it was in the same space. The likes of Robert Langdon, they have identified that basically, you know, there is something going on there. Specifically, the blue stones of Stonehenge have got to do with this 8,000 BC, and it suggests that Stonehenge has everything to do with basically something which dates back to 8,000 BC, and that we should get rid of the 3,000 BC date. So we are pushing everything into the 4,000 BC as the beginning of civilization and history, and everything outside of that we're constantly explaining away. In the case of Bosnia, a number of factors are at work. You know, it began by simply denying that there was anything to this. Even though Bosnia, Serbia, parts of Croatia, Bulgaria are known to be part of the civilization known as Old Europe, which traditionally has been dated to 6,500 to 3,000 BC, because it sits outside of this magic 4,000 BC date, again, it doesn't get studied, even though it is accepted. And here is the very, you know, this is kind of like why science, I have no sympathy for them when they are sometimes confronted with big problems. This civilization, Old Europe, created figures which somewhat look reptilian. Slanted eyes, very intriguing. And around 4,500 BC, they inspired the Sumerian civilization, something known as the Ubaid period in Sumeria, which the likes of David Icke, Zechariah Sitchin, all use as evidence of an alien presence. Well, it's like, you know, you are the ones, science, who exclude constantly this, they came from old Europe. You pretend as if the Ubaid period is largely something which the ancient Sumerians did by themselves. So when people begin to question and say, well, where does this come from? And then they feel somehow that the answer should be alien. It's largely because science refuses to incorporate the old European aspect to this. Even though other scientists, in this case Maria Kimbutas, are talking about it. It's the same thing with as I said, like, you know, with the creationist aspect to it. They shoot themselves in their own foot.
Can you just back up a little bit and explain to our listeners what...
When Sam Osmanagic began to look into the Bosnian pyramid enigma, dating excluding, what it seemed to be and what it seemed to be all about was simply the possibility that this old civilization also was pyramid building. And there was nothing special about it, because the Sumerians built cigarettes, which are, you know, is another word for a pyramid. All of our ancestors were very early on building pyramids. Now, what has happened, as you said, in this year, it is that the pyramid structures of Bosnia have been dated far in excess of anything else, 25,000 BC. But as Ricardo Brett, the lead archaeologist of the Bosnian Pyramid Complex, was saying, elsewhere in Europe, we had civilization. We had Lascaux, you know, and the likes of Dr. Mary Sedekast in her Plato Prehistorian. She basically looks at what Plato writes about Atlantis and what was found in Europe in 25,000 to roughly 10,000 BC, and she finds that it maps. She finds that it's identical. So we know our ancestors had civilization. We know that they were into religion. We know that they were taking care of the dead and the spirits of our ancestors. And so for them to do all of these things and then be building pyramids is not something out of the ordinary. It is not something so unique or something so special. It only becomes special because science, once again, is gung-ho about this 6,000-year-old day for civilization. And anything which, you know, they can't fit in there or they want to explain away. And they go to great lengths about it. You know, the first chapter of the book is called The New Inquisition, and there are some great examples there of how really people who are pushing the change of this paradigm, who are pushing the threshold of civilization back specifically in the 1920s, were thrown in jail. And if they could have burnt them, they would have burnt them at the stake.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that we talk about a lot is what's happening with this new Inquisition. And we're seeing it all around us. We're seeing that there is a backlash, that the backlash against new thought is the rise of the old thought has more teeth and sharper claws. We're also seeing something very interesting with a lot that some of these people who have called themselves sort of new thought or progressive thought people in the past are themselves becoming skeptics, mostly because they're finding it's the best way to get attention for their work. So it's kind of an interesting period to be immersed in all of this, in this burgeoning new age of enlightenment. All this new information is coming forward. And it's an interesting thing to observe how people deal with it. Some people have very open minds about it and are very excited about it and are embracing it. Some people embrace it with no discernment whatsoever and take everything in as acceptable. Some people reject absolutely everything out of hand because they don't want to have their paradigm shifted. So it's really kind of an interesting thing. I think, you know, the word that we always go back to with capital letters is discernment. We have to be discerning about the information that comes through at the same time that I think that we have to be open-minded. But there is a new inquisition happening, that the skeptics are getting louder and more vociferous and more vicious and actually, I think, less reasonable. And this is one of the things that we talk about a lot, and you mentioned briefly in the book, but I know that recently you've come across this, where you're seeing the skeptics kind of shooting themselves in the feet a little bit because they are becoming almost so desperate to stop the new thought from going forward that they're becoming even more... They're becoming even more vicious, but they're also becoming a little more ridiculous. What we're seeing over and over again now, which is another interesting observation, is that the skeptics are making themselves ridiculous and less credible because they're becoming stronger in their need to stop this. And it's becoming kind of obvious that they're so desperate to stop new thought from going forward that they're willing pretty much now to say anything to stop that. Isn't that what you're observing right now?
Yes, I mean, they you know, there's a new movement there. I mean, and you know, they have been dealt, or they were dealt, a big blow with James Randi, which they're now pretending is no longer alive. And basically it had to do with the fact that Randi, you know, we won't discuss his origins, but we will discuss his demise. And it had to do with the fact that the personal vices which he had, which were at the origins of his career as a skeptic, came back to haunt him at the end. And here is a man who is basically, you know, Gung Hu saying, "You are evil. You are there to deceive people." And then to find out that lover boy of his is an illegal immigrant who has been living with him. He then goes through a phase of pretending that he didn't know he was an illegal immigrant, only to find out that, you know, he definitely did know because he'd worked with him before he came to live in his house in Florida, if I'm not mistaken. Is kind of like, hold on, you have been making these claims about other people without any evidence whatsoever, and you are now caught, quite red-handed. And, you know, all of a sudden, Randy has disappeared. Some of his challenges are being taken over by other people, and they are all of a sudden begun again. And there is definitely a smell of what I would say, certain people being pushed forward to take over his reign. Well, at the same time, it's also clear that there is a clear, air of Christian fundamentalism hanging around. And Christian fundamentalists are beginning to realize that for them, the ancient alien thing is something which they didn't expect was going to come back to haunt them. Because to a large extent, what ancient aliens in some aspects, and specifically with the likes of Eric von Däniken, is about is basically saying parts of the Bible are true. They are literal. They have very little to do with morality, which is what the church and most religions want you to believe. But we should treat them as literally factual, and let's start analyzing this. And then what you see is basically, you know, the story of a people who are confronted with enigmatic events and leave stories about these to their descendants, basically saying reality is more complex than you think it is. So Christian fundamentalists have a problem with that because they use the same kind of thing. By default, the fundamentalist will kind of like, you know, take the Bible literally. And in the case of Ancient Aliens Debunked, which is a 3-hour, 10-minute, 44-second and way too long documentary by one of them, Chris White, he actually, towards the end of this documentary, starts going through loopholes and trying to explain to his audience extremely badly about how the Nephilim, these watchers, these creatures who come from the sky downwards, are not extraterrestrial beings, and how the Ancient Alien series as such is completely fabricating this possibility that they're extraterrestrial, even though he has to accept that they're physically real and that they did come from the sky. And then, like, you know, the obvious question to ask is, well, Mr. White, where do they come from? And he leaves this out. He just wants to attack and pretend that everything to do with ancient aliens is wrong. Even though, you know, like, if a creature comes from the sky, is physically real, mates with females of the earth, and creates offspring which is non-human, this is something which Chris White and pretty much most ancient alien theorists agree upon. Isn't the most logical conclusion that they come from somewhere else? That they are extraterrestrial in origin? That they are a non-human intelligence? And for Chris White, the answer is no. And it's kind of like beggar's belief. Like, well, what are they then? You know, if they're not a non-human intelligence, please tell me what they are. And in his case, you know, he's going to go within the biblical framework and tries to explain it away. But there is this attack of the skeptics who are beginning to realize, and it's very much to do with like, you know, like what we've seen before with the Da Vinci Code. They have now realized that people are beginning to think for themselves, and specifically that the younger generation is beginning to question their professors, their high school teachers. This is something which I hear back from high school teachers as well. They say, before Ancient Aliens became so popular, children would just sit there and take dogma for granted. Now, if a grand statement is made, the pupils will go and say, and we got that information from where? Where does this one come from? Why are we led to believe that this is the case? And so teachers are saying that children are beginning to challenge more. There are also university professors who are beginning to say that children at university, specifically after 2 years of basically doing general studies, are beginning to realize that the subject matters of ancient aliens is something which they want to discuss. And so what we're seeing is that the reigning paradigm gets attacked. And this is always the case where the Inquisition will rule its head. And why all of a sudden, in the last few months, you see this outbreak of new inquisitors who truly consider, you know, the likes of us to be heretics, who really want us to burn at the stake, who, you know, put words in our mouths and you know, want us to make it look as if we are basically idiots who are out to deceive. And in the case of Chris White, it's actually very interesting, because this is how he goes about. You know, let's say, for example, that in Ancient Aliens there are indeed five errors, that five bits of information are erroneous. The logical conclusion, therefore, should be that people have made mistakes, and that nobody is infallible, and that maybe, you know, if they're all attributed to one person, let's say it's me, that maybe I'm not as clever, and that I'm definitely making mistakes. Fine, so I'm not clever. However, in the likes of Chris White, he says, well, he made five mistakes. You see, he knows he made these mistakes, and he's out to deceive you, because he purposely twists the truth, and he actually, you know, sets out to deceive you. And this is very much the inquisitorial mindset. It is the fact that we are somehow out there to ensnare your soul, to take you into the bonfire, to hell, and drag your soul down. And it's not logical. Again, if you make five mistakes, if you make 10 mistakes, if you make 100 mistakes, it's more and more evidence of the fact that somebody is stupid. It is not evidence of the fact that somebody is out to deceive. You know, to make the case that you're out to deceive, you need to come up with evidence that even if somebody says something, he actually knows it is wrong. You have to prove that. If you cannot prove that somebody is wrong, that somebody knows he's wrong, but nevertheless sticks to the truth, then you're out to deceive. But simply when you're wrong, it doesn't mean you're out to deceive. And so this is the inquisitorial mindset. It is not just good enough for them to point out errors. We are out there to enslave and deceive. And this is very much, you know, that inquisitorial mindset. And you see it in the past as well. It's on display with Galileo. It's on display pretty much with the Cathar religion. The Cathar, you know, the Inquisition was created to suppress Catharism, because they were the ones who were saying, maybe this dogma of the church isn't the only thing which is out there. Maybe there is other material out there which suggests that there are different opinions and views about this Christianity thing. And dogma simply says, no, you need to go. You are out there, because we know that the church, you know, is all of this. I mean, one of the great ironies of the church is this. When you ask them, well, in the 4th century, you removed things like Jesus being married. You removed the fact that Jesus was just a man, that, you know, he wasn't physically, literally, the Son of God. How did you do that? And they will tell you that they succeeded in conquering these other traditions because it was God who was on their side. God personally, you know, made the bad opinions about Jesus Christ removed from the Bible with the support of, like, you know, the reason why the Vatican won was with the support of God. At no point do they realize that it was active suppression, you know, of their inquisitors, of power structures, and in short, everything of human needs rather than anything to do with God. And the same thing is in evidence throughout history. You know, at the Paradigm Symposium, I gave the example of the magic bullet theory of Kennedy. Somehow, we are in a situation whereby somebody in the Warren Commission in 1964 is confronted with the notion that Kennedy and Connolly have to be shot by one single bullet. And this man is Alan Spector, and he basically says, I can't do this. It's nobody's going to believe this. And he's basically told, do it. So he creates the single bullet theory, which later became known as the magic bullet theory. And when he releases this theory, he says, nobody's going to believe this. This is going to be attacked in a year, 10 years, 100 years from now. Yet somehow, science, and specifically history, has acknowledged this thing as being true because these were the brightest minds of our times. And basically what they... have endorsed this view that Kennedy and Connolly were shot with just one bullet. And everybody who disagrees with this is called a conspiracy nut. It's a conspiracy theory. You need to be slightly cuckoo to believe that Kennedy was shot as part of a conspiracy. Who would doubt the single bullet theory? Well, the guy who invented it felt that everybody should doubt it because it was unbelievable. But we live in a world where stupidity somehow is accepted as historical truth. And that is, again, part of the problem. And it's part of, the lost civilization enigma as to why we are in a situation where all of these lost civilizations are not accepted, are excluded de facto. And it is a mindset which is very, important to realize. It's like, when it comes to the story of Atlantis, you have the likes of Ken Feder who will say, Atlantis doesn't exist. And they truly believe that that it is physically impossible for there to be a civilization 10,000 years old in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Even though we know 10,000 years ago, the sea levels in the Atlantic were lower. That 10,000 years ago, this began to come to an end because of the result of the last ice age. That the ice age, when the ice melted, the sea levels rose. It is a fact that they began to rise precisely at the moment in time when Plato said Atlantis was destroyed by water. It is logical, therefore, to assume that Plato was talking about historical fact. He wrote about it in a book about history. He said it was history. But this mindset of the likes of Ken Feder is so... there are no words to describe it.
Narrow.
To some extent. But there are no words in the sense that he absolutely believes that Atlantis didn't exist. And so everything about Atlantis has to be explained away. Atlantis has to be something which we knew about. Atlantis can't be 10,000 years ago. Plato must have made an error because it's all about the framework. And it is this framework, the zealot framework, which we also see with the Inquisition. The church, it's like, we cannot have a heliocentric solar system. It's impossible because the Bible says that Earth was created by God at the center of the universe. So the sun at the center of the solar system is simply impossible. So we're going to tell everybody that it is impossible. Galileo has to be wrong. It is that kind of same zealotry which you see with the skeptics. And it is not about just debunking. It is about the fact that they're absolutely convinced that their dogmatic framework is the truth and that everybody else is wrong and that everybody else who tries to convince people of a different reality is a heretic who should be burned, and because they can no longer get away with burning, and they are going for personal ad hominem attacks and basically gross misquotations on the likes of the Romney campaign.
Well, you have been very blessed in your life and on this path to have encountered some extraordinary men and women, but you've had some extraordinary teachers, mentors, people that you've learned from, people who you've observed, people who have been up against these kinds of things. And I wanted to talk about a couple of them. I was hoping that maybe you'd talk a little bit about your friendship with Stan Hall and what Stan taught you about the golden cities of South America, because Stan is one of those extraordinary pioneers who you had the opportunity to call your friend, who was a big inspiration for you on this path.
Well, I mean, Stan was, a great long-lost friend. He was a man who... Erik van Däniken and him... basically, what happened was this. In 1969, the English edition of Erik von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods was published. And then Gold of the Gods followed in the early 1970s. And in that book, von Daniken relates a story about how a guy called Juan Moritz, who is an Hungarian expat living in Ecuador, showed him an access to tunnels. And Eric wrote about this, and then Juan Moritz was interviewed for a German magazine, and all of a sudden, Moritz denied an aspect of this. He basically said that he deceived von Daniken, that he didn't show him the tunnel complex, but just a tunnel complex, and that the tunnel complex which he showed Eric had nothing to do with these vast cities. So, headline news, von Daniken exposed, but actually it should have been, you know, von Daniken misled by evil guy, but that didn't ring true. Sorry, that didn't ring, as good as a headline as the other one. So, as these things go, because, you know, everybody likes the headline, people just felt that von Daniken was exposed, and definitely the skeptics felt that there was nothing through it, and forever after will they quote Eric von Daniken. Stan Hall, at that moment in time, was living in Ecuador. He made contact with Juan Moritz. He wanted to push this further. He wanted to see what was what. And in 1976, he organized an expedition which involved the military, which was extremely big. It had the project sponsor directorship of Neil Armstrong, who on July 31st, 1976, personally came down for a few days to inspect and descend into the Taos Cave. The remarkable finds were made there, but you know, it was identified that this Taos Cave was not the cave of a lost civilization, not this mythical metal library. And forever after, Stan Hall stuck with this, and he persevered, and he realized that this Moritz dude really was a problematic character, and the reason why he lied was that Moritz wasn't the key. Moritz had basically heard the story from somebody else, and when Moritz died, Stan realized how he too had been misled and had been looking in the wrong locations, because Moritz didn't know the right location. Moritz basically had been told the story of a metal library, had no idea where it was, and you know, had been pushing people into a certain direction. But Stan identified who the person was, and became dear friends with that person. But Stan was, you know, a person who also realized that Ecuador, you know, was far more important, and that we continuously made this civilization, which was there in South America, less than it was. And to some extent, we're slowly catching up with all of these things. We're slowly beginning to realize what is going on there. But also something I think which Stan showed, and this is something which I think the Western world doesn't get right now. And this is something that in South America, specifically Middle and South America specifically, that there was a time about a century ago when Western people, the likes of Mitchell Hedges, various other explorers, came there and they were welcomed by these tribes. They were shown things like crystal skulls. In the case of the contact people of Stan Hall, you know, they were shown certain things to do with what these native cultures had. They wanted to share this with the rest of the world. And then these tribes learned some great lessons, which are unfortunately also very bad lessons. One of them is that several of these explorers, and actually not the likes of Mitchell Hedges, but various other explorers, the likes of Juan Moritz is probably one example, did this for personal gain, personal satisfaction. But specifically, what is happening is the following, that an awful lot of these tribes show certain things, quite often to science, and the scientists basically say, well, these tribes have it all wrong. What these people are showing is not true. And the Father Crespi collection is probably the best example of this. Father Crespi came out with several metal plates which had inscriptions. The local Indians brought him this because they knew that Father Crespi was going to give him vital medication, vital food if they needed it. They were going to help take care of these tribes. And Crespi didn't ask for this, but these people had so much of an exchange culture that they felt they had to give them something. And they didn't have anything except pretty much treasure from their ancestors. So they gave that to Father Crespi, and Father Crespi carefully stored it, catalogued it. And the likes of Erik von Däniken came there, and various other people came there, reported about it, and that was great. But scientists for decades basically said, this is fake, these people have no metal, you know, and almost using the fact that Erik von Däniken never set foot there as specific evidence of the fact that it has to be all fake, you know, because that's a great trick science is able to do as well. Well, only recently are scientists, few of them, beginning to accept the fact that actually these people in South America did use metal, and that they did make them into tiny, very thin sheets and use them for writing purposes. And all of a sudden, you kind of say, so you are now accepting of the fact that the Crespi collection is real? And the answer is no. Why? Because it has been condemned, and it still sits there in the condemned corner of history. And it is, you know, it is so sad to see this. And the people, you know, the native cultures are basically saying, and why are we speaking to these scientists? Why are we talking to these anthropologists? Each time we tell them something about our culture, the scientists will say, we are stupid. We don't know what we're talking about. We have faked this. This is unimportant. So we're just going to shut up. We're going to wait for a time when Western science is actually treating us with respect. And then we will open up our minds again. And, you know, then we will explain certain things. But meanwhile, we're going to keep quiet because basically, you know, we are fed up by being exploited and by being denied proper credit for what we truly were. And so it's a very sad situation to be in. And to a large extent, you know, science is laughing because they have been able to shut up the indigenous cultures, one of the last great treasure houses of information. They have managed to, you know, silence as well by basically bullying them, by basically telling them that they are idiots, that they have nothing to say. And so that is a very sad situation. And again, it's a situation which has resulted in the fact that this paradigm of somehow accepting that we're only 6,000 years old remains alive, remains in power and in place.
We really haven't progressed since the days of Galileo in terms of this kind of an inquisition. Because what you're right, I mean, what really is happening is indigenous cultures over and over again are told that they're superstitious, that their material, their legends, the things that come from their traditions, and even the physical proof of the ancient nature of their culture just doesn't matter. In fact, in many cases, they're told it just simply doesn't exist, even when there is solid evidence of it. And it's an amazing thing to see in the 21st century that this approach still is in place. You know, the same approach that condemned Galileo and people like Bruno is still happening all over the world. And, it, you know, as I said earlier, there seems to be this sort of resurgence of it as more and more evidence about our ancient past is starting to come forward and more discoveries are being made. And that's one of the things that I'm really excited about is, you know, every day when you turn on the computer and see, you know, what's happening in the news, you never know what kind of new discovery is going to be out there because it seems like so much is coming out now, but people are so afraid of it. How would you summarize the importance of the Father Crespi collection and what Stan and Eric were looking at in South America in terms of what it teaches us about lost civilizations? Like, what's the single most important thing that we take away from what was happening there in Ecuador?
Well, it's basically the fact that, you know, civilization is not as linear as we want it to be. And this... you know, we have this notion civilization existed out of the Middle East, made its way into various corners, and then at some point you had some cultures in the New World, but they didn't really amount to much. And that is simply not true. South America had great civilizations. They, you know, they had metal. The fact that they didn't use metal in a similar fashion to the rest of the world doesn't mean anything. You know, to a large extent, not using gold for currency is, in my opinion, a far cleverer thing than to use it as a gold standard. And it also, you know, it's part and parcel of the fact that South America is really far more developed, and this is in evidence on so many places. For example, in the case of the Amazon Basin, we know that the earliest people who went there spoke of cities which had 20,000 people living in it, vast complexes. And then 50, 100 years later, people went in there again and they said, but there's nobody here. There aren't any cities. All of these people, you know, what were these early explorers saying? And there's this view that they just invented it, that somehow the great early explorers just bragged about it, making it look more interesting. And you would kind of go like, oh yeah, that's a physical trait, isn't it? That's like what mankind does. They don't find anything and then they're going to pretend that they found something real. Well, that's not the case. You know, time and time again, it's shown that these early explorers found precisely what they said they found. And in this case, satellite imagery is finally showing that our ancestors were indeed there, that there are vast cities, that there were these complex structures, that they somehow were able to create something called terra preta, which is this kind of soil which makes pretty much something which is infertile fertile, and through technological means that 500 years after it was created, it is still you know, of great potential and still one of the great civilizing factors in this world. So we, I mean, you know, one of the things I hate in the Celestine prophecy is basically that South America is treated as if it has no culture. Part of whatever his name is, Redfield, who wrote the Celestine prophecy, he basically says South America is idiotic. There's nothing there, and the Incas only really existed because people from Mexico descended down and did these things. That is such a load of crap. South America had a great civilization, and this is something which, you know, in the Lost Civilization Enigma, I'm trying to point out as well. And I don't go into too much because, you know, it would take another book to explain, but I think I give enough information to show that whether we are talking about Middle America, South America, North Europe, or Middle East, specifically Egypt, that what we're confronted with there are remnants. That at some point there was indeed a lost civilization of Atlantis. Thousands of years old, and that this was truly a civilization which was far ahead of its time, which is why the likes of the ancient Egyptians and Plato wrote about it, because they wanted to show that it was far ahead of its time and they wanted to underline its importance. And that the other civilizations built upon this, that after a few thousand years of relative nothingness, civilization once again became fueled, and we began to once again fuel this and began to work with this. And that hence the Mayan civilization, the Inca civilization, the Megalithic civilization, the Egyptian civilization were all pretty much rekindled from this lost civilization. And that each one of them contains sparks and evidences of this lost civilization. And that is something, once again, which, you know, standard historians don't want you to hear, because they are very much in an isolationist stance. They pretend that the old world never communicated with the new world. Heck, you know, when it comes to the likes of Stonehenge and Avebury, two megalithic monuments, which are hardly 20 miles apart, there are one or two in academic circles who are actually studying them together. Everybody else is just concentrating on its own. And it's like saying, you know, oh, you know, imagine you have a house and you have a scientist working on your garage, trying to explain who built the garage, and then somehow somebody is pretending that your kitchen, is no part of the same building, because there's a living room in between. It is that kind of atmosphere which is reigning in science. And you kind of like wonder about, well, you know, is there nobody who sees the fact that this is part of the same house? No. Of course not, because, you know, one of them is a kitchen, one of them is a garage. It's two different things. How dare you say that they're part of the same thing? It's that kind of attitude which, you know, is once again denying us certain things. And in the book, again, The Lost Civilization Enigma, I go into quite a bit of evidence showing that this cross-cultural aspect, both contact between the New World and the Old World, definitely dates back to 3000 BC. That this notion that somehow we developed completely independent of each other is another great myth which science holds intact, you know, and pretends to hold intact. Even if they sometimes admit that the Vikings traveled to the New World, it's done with utter disdain. It's like, oh yeah, the Vikings went there. And you kind of like wonder, like, well, did they go back to Scandinavia and talk about it? You know, would you like to do some research on this? And basically, you know, the answer is no. When you look at all of these examples, you will find, you know, when it comes to the megalithic civilization, when it comes to science, there's only one professor called Barry Cunliffe who's really mapped this in as a whole. Nobody else is doing it. And it is sad. It is so, so sad to see that we keep this isolationist stance. And sometimes it beggars belief. You know, somehow people seem to think, or scientists seem to think, that the border between Mexico and the United States existed at the times of the Mayans. You know, it's simply ridiculous notions like that. And it truly beggars belief. But once again, it all has to do with politics. It all has to do with keeping a certain paradigm in place, a paradigm which came about in the last 100 years, and which now is vociferously defended, by, you know, everybody. And it is so entrenched that what we consider to be our history is truly not our history at all. It is a completely fabricated construct which has nothing to do with reality whatsoever.
But don't you think that there is a certain amount of baby and bathwater going on here? I mean, I think that one of the things that we all struggle with is, going back to the big D word of discernment, is that there is a certain amount of silliness that rises out of some of the New Age concepts that sets all of us back a little bit. Now, at its most ridiculous, let's go to things like when we talk about Atlantis, which you refer to in your book as the Big A, one of my favorite subjects and something that you and I have been working on together and separately for many, many years. But, you know, I think about, gosh, when I was growing up here in the 70s, there was that show Man from Atlantis, and you have the kind of ridiculousness of, you know, the man with the webbed feet and these sort of fantasy ideas of Atlantis being this underwater civilization and people with high-tech submarines running around and, you know, mental waves going out to seahorses and dolphins. And, you know, there becomes this sort of certain mythology that's very fantasy and fairy tale. And even sort of the nouveau pagan stuff that grows up, that grows around Stonehenge and all of that. I think that what happens is we tend to get very tangled up in the silliness of it. And that feeds the skeptics. They say, you know, it's the whole concept of calling someone a pyramidiot, right? People who believe the pyramids are older, or who believe that there were other intelligences involved in building them. Well, they're all lumped into this category of, cranks, right? We all get stuck into that. Well, if you believe these things, you know, you believe in little men from Mars and people swimming around in Atlantis, and that makes you a crank. And I think that we will always have to overcome that. And I think that it makes it very easy for the skeptics to say, see, you're all in this category of people who are on the lunatic fringe. So I think that the big question for me is, what is the answer to overcoming that? And I'm going to answer the question first by saying books like yours, which are very factual, incredibly well researched. There's at least 15 years of your life in this book, The Lost Civilization Enigma. There is so much detail in here that you respond so well to these questions with in such a thorough way. You know, I was thinking that listening to that idiot who did the debunking video. Chris White, was that his name? Sorry. I don't think I'm allowed to call him an idiot on the air, but I think I just did. But when I was listening to him on somebody else's show trying to defend himself, And it's ridiculous to hear him talk when he's interviewed live, because it's all, yeah, well, some guy told me that, or I got that somewhere, you know, and I listen to people like that, and he has absolutely no ability to respond to any of the questions, because he really doesn't know what he's talking about, versus someone like you, who has all of this information, so many years of data and detail and research. And so I think the answer is people like you who are coming forward, who have run with the legacy that Eric von Daniken began in the 70s and are growing that legacy. I think that it is people like you and books like this that are going to change that paradigm. But I guess my question is, how hard is it going to be to overcome all of this, the silliness and the fantasies that are out there about these lost civilizations, so that people will finally take this seriously and understand that as human beings, we are spectacular and capable of amazing things?
Well, if we take the truth as it being in the middle, there is a plus side and a negative side on each side. And the more skeptics are going in one direction, in the negative side, the more I quite often feel that, what do you want to call them, New Age or believers, go into the opposite thing. Believing in a man of Atlantis is as ridiculous as believing that the island of Thera or Santorini is the location of Atlantis. Neither of them fit whatsoever with the true story of Atlantis. And I think, the paradigm is this. Largely to what New Age people, if they go out too extreme, that doesn't necessarily change anything. But if the skeptic crowd or the other thing, goes to the far negative, the truth is kind of like no longer in the middle, so to speak. And various people are beginning to see that people with authority, which by default the New Age, in this era in which we live in, will never have, that the skeptics are being shown to be complete idiots as well. And that interaction of truth, of known facts, and the skeptical attitude, that is kind of like the interaction. And what I try to do with the book is point out the known facts, whereby you can say to a skeptic, Mr. Skeptic, this is simply not true. You know, this is simply not the case. And that's, I think, what can bring about the paradigm. The truth simply is. You can debate all you want. And this is something which I say in the book about Atlantis, on the subject of Atlantis. Atlantis, the evidence is definitely there that it existed. But where we definitely need to come to a compromise is that the ancient Egyptians believed in Atlantis. There is no doubt about this whatsoever. And so for a skeptic to say Atlantis didn't exist, Plato did all of these things, they are denying the fact that this story comes out of ancient Egypt and that the ancient Egyptians were absolutely convinced about it. And those are the kind of things which, you can hurt skeptics with, by basically saying you have created this framework about Atlantis and you're making circular arguments because you've been able to create this framework, but your framework is simply not the case. You have created this in your head. This is a complete fallacy. And so we can make sure that this negative thing of the balance on the skeptics comes closer to the truth. And in a number of cases, this happens very quickly through circumstances. And in a number of other cases, it's a step-by-step process. But in the final analysis, by education of the public, by basically the public no longer saying, Mr., your dogma is simply not in line with the truth, we move closer to the truth and it gets aligned. And you see that happening in a number of occasions. As much as I hate the historical Jesus debate, the fact of the matter is that some people are actually now discussing the historical nature of Jesus. They pretend that he's somehow different from the Jesus in the Bible. Another carefully somewhat quaint scenario which they have concocted. But at least we're getting there. At least we're going into this direction of getting closer to the truth. As I said, sometimes it's a step-by-step process. Sometimes it gets really paradigm shifty.
Well, The Lost Civilization Enigma is the new book from my best-selling beloved, Philip Coppens. It is a follow-up to The Ancient Alien Question. I absolutely love this book, not just because I'm married to the author, but because it really does explore all of these things in such wonderful detail. If you want to get a little bit of a taste of some of the super-secret Atlantis research we're doing, there is the Atlantis chapter in this book. The Lost Civilization Enigma is available where all fine books are sold. You can get it anywhere online. You can get it at your local bookstores. They can order it for you if they don't carry it. Absolutely fantastic book. And until next time,
from the both of us,
the truth against the world.